Ça prend une bonne dose de courage et de persévérance pour traverser une pandémie.
Ça prend aussi une bonne dose de patience, de résilience, de confiance, d'optimisme, d'humour.
Do you need quality sounds? Tune into CKUT 90.3 on the frequency modulation band radio. www.ckut.ca on the internet. Streaming audio, archive shows, and information.
CKUT.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Legalese, a broadcast about the law cast broadly. I'm Amelia.
And I'm Gwen.
Your host for this month's edition of Legalese. On today's show, we'll be hearing about different facets of Islamophobia. We'll start by talking about Canada's draconian security certificate regime and its disproportionate targeting of Muslim men. Then we'll also talk about the normalization of Islamophobia through Canadian militarism in the Middle East. Basically, first we'll hear from Adil Sharkawi and Sophie Harkat, who spoke at a panel hosted by Cupert McGill and the Collectif Canadien Anti-Islamophobie this past spring.
Adil a été emprisonnée du mai 2003 jusqu'à février 2005 et par la suite vivait sous conditions jusqu'à qu'il gagne son procès à la Cour suprême au mois de septembre 2009. Donc il nous raconte son expérience et la lutte qui a mené à l'invalidation de son certificat de sécurité. We'll then hear from Sophie Harkat, who is the wife of Mohamed Harkat, who was imprisoned from December 2002 until May 2006 and is still under strict conditions of house arrest and faces potential deportation to torture. And then finally, we'll hear a speech from organizer Saeed Hassan, who spoke at an event at McGill organized by RAD Law, the Muslim Law Students Association, and the Women of Color Collective in March of this year. Hassan speaks about the normalization of Islamophobia through such incidents as the Quebec mosque shooting and the wild-scale targeting of and killings of Muslims in the Middle East, backed and carried out by Canadian militarism.
So to start off the show today, here's Dawina by Montreal Algerian group La Besse.
انت واش درت في حياتك يا حبيبي واحد شومبيط الاخر بومبي واحد بزناسي والاخر فنان اما نايا بسقوا عليا الماريكان اما نايا بسقوا عليا الماريكان فاميلتي واحد قاري الاخر يقري في اليونيفرسيتي يحيى عنده فيلا في برج الكيفان اما نايا بسقوا عليا الماريكان اما نايا بسقوا عليا الماريكان شيش ما ينوتش بالغربة لي غطو حتى الدلع عسقاوه بالسيقو الحم الحمار باعوه في شعبان اما نايا بسقوا عليا الماريكان اما نايا بسقوا عليا الماريكان محمار
الطياره من الفيلو للطوموبيل صالون بطاقه المصغر كاع بالموبيل هذه اللي فوليسو انا هو اللي عيان ناجم بويزو البالو عليه الماريكان ناجم بويزو البالو عليه الماريكان
Just heard Dawina by La Bess, and now we turn to the part of our show in which we'll be featuring pieces on the Canadian security certificate regime. So to give an introduction on how security certificates work, it's pretty complicated and not a lot of people know about it. We're going to play an excerpt from the Secret Trial 5 film. And for a little bit of context, security certificates have been described as a Kafka-esque tool. They allow for indefinite detention without charges under the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, and based on evidence that is not revealed to the accused or their lawyers.
So over the last decade, this rare and highly controversial or very oppressive device has been used to detain 5 men for more than 30 years combined. Over 27 of them have been issued since 1991, and most people who were named under security certificates have been deported, and only 5 have actually been withdrawn. Mohamed Harkat and Mohamed Mahmoud Jabala all have outstanding certificates since 2002, 2001, and 2000, respectively, and all are currently under strict conditions of house arrest. With the exception of 3, all are men of color, and most are from Muslim-majority countries.
Right, and as far as I understand, I think security certificates can only be issued against somebody who is a foreign national. It's
or a permanent resident as well.
Right, exactly. So yeah. Somebody who is not a Canadian citizen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which, yeah, it's pretty messed up.
So they're going to explain in this short video.
Initially, certificates are supposed to start with CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, which is engaged in all sorts of investigations around individuals that it thinks might jeopardize the security of Canada.
It may begin to develop a file on somebody and come to the conclusion that someone constitutes a threat.
And then they bring that material before 2 government ministers, the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration and the Minister of Public Safety.
So CSIS shares the information with the 2 ministers, who then sign off if they decide it's warranted.
Then the matter would be referred to a federal court judge, and the judge would review the secret evidence.
And it's essentially up until you get to the federal court, the person concerned has no idea that this is going on. It takes place behind closed doors.
And a judge of the federal court evaluates the dossier's intelligence. On the basis of that evaluation, will deem the security certificate to be either reasonable or unreasonable.
Not whether or not there were valid grounds for issuing it, not whether the decision of the two ministers was correct, but merely whether it was reasonable.
That's very different from beyond a reasonable doubt, which is used in a criminal proceeding.
The goal of the security certificate is to deport someone.
That would be subject to a few caveats, however. Canada is not supposed to be deporting people to face a substantial risk of torture in any event.
It's completely illegal under international and domestic law to carry out that process.
And secondly,
the fundamentals of the case, indeed the most central part of the case against the person, may be kept secret and not disclosed to the person concerned or their lawyer.
So it would be a secret hearing before a judge, and the only other people in the room would be government lawyers, and a public hearing. But the problem with the public hearing, of course, is
neither he nor his counsel know precisely what he is alleged to have done.
In other words, you get locked up based on evidence that you never see, and that's very difficult to challenge. So that's, I mean, in a nutshell, that's what the procedure is.
That was an excerpt from the Secret Trial 5 film. The film is really worth seeing, and for more information, you can go to its website or watch it online at secrettrial5.com.
So two people who have appeared in that film also spoke here in Montreal this spring, Adil Sharkawi and Sophie Harkat, who's the wife of Mohamed Harkat. Mohamed couldn't be there due to the conditions he is currently under in Ottawa under his security certificate. Adil Sharkawi was imprisoned under a security certificate from May 2003 until February 2005, and he was held under conditions until the security certificate was thrown out in September 2009. Sharkawi was notably involved in two Supreme Court constitutional challenges of the security certificate regime. And while neither directly led to his case being stayed, his team persuaded the Supreme Court of Canada that the security certificate regime was denying fundamental justice in the first case by not giving defendants any form of access to the information needed to defend themselves, and in the second case, by destroying key documents.
And Sophie Harkat is the wife of Mohamed Harkat, who has been in Canada since 1995. And in 1997, he was given refugee status after successfully claiming government persecution if he were returned to Algeria. On December 10th, 2002, Mohamed was arrested outside his home in Ottawa, and he spent 1 year of his 3.5-year detention in solitary confinement. He was released on bail on June 21st, 2006, with the strictest conditions in Canadian history, and has been under those conditions ever since, and currently still faces deportation. Mohamed also challenged his certificate at Supreme Court, but lost on the grounds that the security certificate against him with a new system that was put in place after Sharkawi was considered reasonable.
So Sophie Harkat also brings up Bill C-51, which, as many already know, is a Harper Conservative era bill that drew wide criticism for expanding the powers of the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, or CSIS. The current government has proposed an amended version of the bill that will try to be more specific in what power CSIS is granted and clarify that, quote-unquote, terrorism propaganda must mean counseling an individual to commit an act of terrorism, while also reducing the maximum sentence for this offense from life to 5 years of imprisonment. The amended bill itself is still quite controversial due to its own allowances in favor of the security state.
Yeah, so here is Adil Sharkawi, followed by Sophie Harkat.
Abordé ce soir trois points. Le premier, je ne sais pas si vous connaissez ce poème d'un pasteur allemand. Ça a été attribué à un pasteur allemand, Martin Niemöller. First they came, quand ils sont venus me chercher. Alors, j'en ai fait un pastiche aujourd'hui. Quand ils sont venus me chercher, quand ils sont venus chercher les sans-papiers, je n'ai rien dit, parce que je n'étais pas un sans-papier. Et quand ils sont venus chercher les réfugiés, je n'ai rien fait, parce que je n'étais pas un réfugié. Quand ils sont venus chercher les immigrants, parenthèse et résidents permanents, je n'ai rien fait, parce que je ne suis pas un immigrant, je suis un citoyen de souche. Quand ils sont venus me chercher, il n'y avait plus personne pour moi. Les certificats de sécurité, quand ils ont commencé, c'était une loi exceptionnelle qui servaient à déporter des étrangers, des sans-papiers ou des réfugiés. Et moi, quand j'étais arrêté en 2003, j'étais le premier résident permanent à être arrêté. Et il y a eu une rencontre avec le ministre de la Justice de l'époque, qui était un ministre libéral, Erin Cutler. Et lui, ce qu'il nous a dit, il dit, M. Charkaoui, vous militez pour avoir l'égalité et pour que vous soyez traité de la même manière que tous les citoyens. Ne vous en faites pas. Nous travaillons très fort pour abolir les certificats de séjour, pour que ce type de loi soit appliqué à tout le monde. Personne libérale, pas conservatrice. Donc on va faire de notre mieux que ça soit appliqué à tout le monde. Qu'est-ce qui s'est passé après la période de la lutte contre le terrorisme de George W. Bush? On est rendu aujourd'hui, en 2018, ça a commencé en 2010, ça a commencé sous Obama. On a commencé à parler de la radicalisation. Avec la radicalisation, on a commencé à appliquer des procédures exceptionnelles aux citoyens. Il fallait s'adapter. Parce que là, le danger n'était plus un danger qui semblait de l'extérieur. C'était la deuxième et troisième génération née ici. Là, le système s'est adapté. Qu'est-ce qu'ils utilisent aujourd'hui? Moi, je peux dire que pour les certificats de sécurité, ça a été une grande victoire au niveau de la Cour suprême. Et là, je vais mettre mon dernier point. Parce qu'il y a une manière de voir les choses, celle des avocats, puis il y a une autre manière d'interpréter les choses, la nôtre, celle des militants. On n'a pas la même interprétation, je vais vous dire pourquoi. Mais il n'y a plus eu de certificat de sécurité signé après la décision de la Cour suprême. Ils ont essayé avec un espion russe. C'était fake. L'espion russe en question a été déporté, le certificat a été annulé parce qu'il est parti par lui-même. Ben, un espion, on le déporte dans son pays d'origine. Ben, il est reçu avec le tapis rouge. C'est pas la même chose. C'est pas comme quelqu'un que tu accuses d'être un membre dormant, une cellule dormante d'Al-Qaïda, puis tu l'envoies au Maroc ou en Algérie ou en Syrie ou en Égypte. C'est pas la même chose. Donc ils l'ont signé, gouvernement Harper, pour dire à tout le monde, nous allons continuer à signer des certificats de sécurité. Mais ça a été un fiasco. Et depuis ce jour, il y a eu zéro certificat de sécurité de signé. Pour nous, l'objectif a été atteint. Par contre, là je parle aux jeunes qui sont là. Je parle aux deux souches qui sont nés ici. Maintenant, il y a l'application du 810, l'article du code criminel, qui permet, sans porter des accusations, forcer une personne à respecter des conditions, et si la personne refuse, elle s'expose à une peine de 12 mois. Un 810, dans le code criminel, n'entraîne pas des antécédents judiciaires, parce qu'il n'y a pas d'accusation. Mais tu t'engages à respecter, à garder la paix ou à respecter des conditions. Dans l'affaire de mise en œuvre, on m'a offert un 810. J'ai dit non, et je me suis battu pendant 2 ans, et la décision va tomber mercredi prochain. Décision d'accusation de voie de fait simple et d'agression armée. L'arme, c'est une porte. Alors, la première des choses qu'ils ont dit, on vous offre un deal, une entente. Respectez un 810 pour 1 an, mais ça va sortir dans tous les médias. Charkaoui avoue avoir tabassé un agent de sécurité, et après 1 an, vous n'allez être ni poursuivi, vous n'allez pas avoir de prison à faire, mais on va appliquer le 810. Alors, la plupart des jeunes, soi-disant radicalisés, on leur a appliqué des 810 pour qu'on leur mette des bracelets GPS. Ceux qu'on a portés, que j'ai portés pendant 4 ans et demi. Seulement 10 mois, parce qu'il a été libéré très en retard, et il a gagné son dossier. Mais ton mari, Sophie, le...
7 ans et demi.
7 ans et demi, c'est ça. Moi, je l'ai porté pendant 4 ans et demi. Alors, j'ai commencé par vous expliquer qu'au début, on ciblait les sans-papiers, les immigrants, les réfugiés. Il n'y a pas eu de mobilisation. C'est vrai, quand on parle de mobilisation, le Diane, qui n'a pas été abordé par Mary, qui était quand même au centre de cette lutte, avec Matthew Behrens, Diane, une fois, elle est partie dans une rencontre d'imams. Puis elle a commencé par leur dire « Je suis juive, lesbienne, et je défends le droit de Hassan à être traité équitablement. Et vous, les imams, les mosquées, vous ne faites rien. » Alors, pour vous dire qu'il n'y a pas eu de mobilisation, ce qu'on a vu, c'est les familles, avec quelques militants, qui ont réussi à former une coalition disparate, où il y avait des anarchistes, des communistes, des maoïstes, un petit peu de tout, mais en grande partie des anarchistes, avec des militants pour les droits des immigrants, avec aussi des avocats. Moi, mes avocates, elles n'ont pas fait ça pour l'argent. Dominique Larocher est devenue juge aujourd'hui. Joanne Doyon, elle était épuisée après des années de lutte, mais elles n'ont pas fait ça pour l'argent, elles n'étaient pas payées. Elles faisaient du pro bono. Elles croyaient dans la cause. Alors, faites attention. Si vous ne vous mobilisez pas pour défendre les droits des jeunes qui sont taxés de radicalisation aujourd'hui, croyez-moi, le système s'adapte, le système évolue. Il y a un agenda sécuritaire, et cet agenda sécuritaire est toujours mis de l'avant par différents gouvernements, que ce soit les conservateurs, que ce soit les libéraux, que ce soit le NPD, n'importe quel gouvernement qui va être au pouvoir, il y a un lobby qui est derrière, qui va lui mettre de l'avant un agenda sécuritaire qui va être adapté selon le gouvernement, selon les situations en place. Vous avez vu en France, que ce soit la gauche, que ce soit la droite, certains vont dire que ce n'est pas une vraie gauche, en tout cas, que ce soit une gauche caviar, ça reste la gauche. Ils vont appliquer les mêmes mesures. Deuxième point, les droits ne se donnent pas, les droits s'arrachent. Et mon message est pour ceux qui croient dans ces associations musulmanes, qui passent leur temps à prendre des selfies, à serrer des mains, à organiser des soupers et à prétendre représenter la communauté musulmane en faisant du lobbying. Ces gens-là, moi, je ne les ai jamais vus quand j'étais en prison, ni après ma libération. Mais ils sont en train de polluer Facebook avec leurs selfies et avec des images qui, à mon avis, nous ont pas aidés. Cette cause a été gagnée devant les tribunaux et dans la rue. Quand je dis dans la rue, j'englobe les universités, les centres communautaires, les mosquées, les églises, on était partout.
On a même soumis des affaires.
C'est ça. Alors, parce qu'au niveau juridique, on n'avait pas la même lecture. Dans Charkaoui 1, devant la Cour suprême, nous on demandait que la loi soit abolie. Les avocats qui représentaient le Hassan et Mohamed demandaient avoir plus de fenêtres dans la cellule, avec tout mon respect. Demandez à un avocat spécial. Alors, même si moi j'ai gagné mon dossier, entre autres, grâce aux avocats spéciaux, mais je n'ai jamais été satisfait par cette avenue juridique. Donc on n'avait pas la même lecture, mais on a travaillé ensemble, et publiquement, on demandait tous l'abolition. Mais ce qui était envoyé par certains avocats, ce n'était pas l'abolition. Donc des fois, ils disaient, voilà, abolé, je te sécure le certificate. Mais ce qu'ils envoyaient comme requête, c'était special advocate, amicus courrier, des abus juridicaux. Alors, d'où mon deuxième point, c'est que sans lutte, il n'y a point de droit. Les droits s'arrachent. Vraiment à la Malcolm X, pas à la Martin Luther King. C'est ce que j'ai vécu et c'est ce que je crois. Troisième point, l'interprétation. Comment on interprète les choses? Ça, c'est important. Vous savez, quand la décision de la Cour suprême est sortie, en 2007, le premier communiqué de presse qui a été écrit. Qu'est-ce qu'ils disent, les Brits, lobby sioniste? Ils disent, nous sommes très satisfaits de la décision de la Cour suprême. La Cour suprême s'est rendue à nos arguments de la récupération. Ils disent que c'est vrai que les certificats de sécurité contreviennent aux droits humains. Néanmoins, la Cour suprême a donné au gouvernement un an pour réécrire une autre version des certificats de sécurité. Alors, moi, avant de sortir dans la conférence de presse, il y avait un avocat qui représentait la Ligue des droits et libertés. Et j'avais beau lui expliquer, regarde, j'ai dit, ne détruis pas la décision, ne dis pas que c'est une mauvaise décision, dis, c'est une grande victoire, moi je sais que c'est pas une grande victoire. Mais je lui explique, ne sors pas devant les médias pour leur dire, c'est une décision qui est mi figue, mi raisin, n'a pas réalisé grand chose. De toute façon, il va avoir un an. J'y sors dire que la Cour suprême a tapé sur les lois du gouvernement. Elle leur a dit votre loi ne marche pas. Il ne faudrait plus avoir de loi. Vous ne pouvez pas rencontrer les exigences de la Cour suprême. Vous savez, dans un match de boxe, de hockey par exemple, il y a le match et l'après-match. Dans l'après-match, les analystes ils commencent à parponner. Et ils te font changer la défaite en victoire. N'est-ce pas? Et juste, alors, moi, pourquoi j'aborde ce point? Cette récupération, cette lecture de la lutte et des certificats de sécurité, c'est que, malheureusement, on n'a pas documenté, il n'y a pas eu de livres qui ont été écrits, cette expérience. Et j'ai peur qu'elle se perde, que de nouvelles générations qui sont encore élevées dans la peur, moi je vois beaucoup de personnes qui ont encore peur juste de parler. Cheikh Hassan me disait à la blague, si je veux qu'un imam rentre dans le rang, je vais lui dire Charkaou va venir dans ta mosquée. Il va avoir peur. Non, t'as peur, les gens tremblent. Alors, on n'a pas documenté, il faudrait que les jeunes générations s'impliquent. Mohamed Harkat n'est pas encore un homme tout à fait libre. Ses droits ne sont pas encore respectés. Quand on a été libéré, ils ont voulu transformer nos maisons en prison. C'est de la détention dans la collectivité. Donc, ils ont mis des caméras chez vous. Ils ont interdit Internet. Moi, j'étais privé d'Internet de 2003-2009, pendant 6 ans. Pas d'Internet, 6 ans et demi. Quand on parle de la lutte, ce n'est pas seulement les manifestations. La lutte, ce n'est pas seulement le travail devant les tribunaux. Il y a une lutte qui est plus, je dirais, minutieuse, que les gens peut-être vont ridiculiser. Mais je vous donne des exemples. Chaque fois, je demandais à mes avocats, parce que moi, j'avais le droit à réviser mes conditions chaque mois. À chaque mois, je disais, je vais emmener mes enfants au parc safari. Je vais aller faire du ski. Je veux aller voir les chutes du Niagara Falls. Je veux aller à l'île du Prince-Édouard. Je les ai fait souffrir, le gouvernement. Chaque mois, j'avais 4, 5, 6 demandes. Après, j'ai dit, je veux étudier. Je vais terminer ma maîtrise. Quand j'ai terminé ma maîtrise, j'ai dit, je vais rédiger une mémoire. Ils m'ont dit pas d'ordinateur, je l'ai fait à la main. J'ai rédigé mon mémoire à la main. Je veux ma bibliographie, ils ont dit pas de bibliothèque. Alors je devais aller voir les nouveaux livres. Je prenais le livre, j'allais regarder la bibliographie pour voir les nouveaux, la nouvelle publication. Pour les publications scientifiques, ils m'ont permis d'avoir un accès via le bibliothécaire de l'Université de Montréal pour aller chercher, par exemple, les données dans les... dans les banques de données. Alors, il y a une autre, ce militantisme de tous les jours, se s'exprimer par le fait qu'après la maîtrise, j'ai dit, je vais faire mon doctorat. Je vais aller à l'île du Prince-Édouard. Je vais aller en Colombie-Britannique. Je faisais des demandes. Et à chaque demande, je grignotais, je gagnais un petit peu de terrain. Donc, c'est vrai que tu as un grand slogan, qui est celui d'abolir les certificats de sécurité, mais ce grand slogan... il ne va pas s'exprimer seulement par de grands pas. En parallèle, tu fais des petits pas. À chaque fois, tu empiètes davantage sur le terrain de l'autre. Parce que eux, ce qu'ils veulent, c'est t'isoler. Te laisser seul. Si quelqu'un te parle, il le visite. Il lui rend visite. Si quelqu'un t'appelle, le lendemain, il a une visite chez lui à domicile. Il essaie de t'isoler dans ta communauté et dans la société. Et ça ne va jamais... se terminer. Julius Gray, l'avocat que vous connaissez, certains peuvent l'aimer, d'autres ne peuvent pas l'aimer. Dans mon dossier, moi, ce qu'il avait dit à mon père et à ma famille, il a dit, même si votre Allah descend sur terre, Ali ne sortira pas de prison. C'est fini pour lui. Et pour que je m'assoie avec vous, vous devez payer $10,000. Première des choses. Et il a dit, lui, il ne sortira jamais. Mais lui, il a dit un point important. Il a dit, toute personne qui se respecte au Canada a nécessairement un dossier à la GRC. Et il avait donné plusieurs exemples. Ed Broadbent, par exemple, Jack Layton, des personnes qui sont devenues politically correct. Alors, je vais vous laisser le soin de poser des questions aux invités. J'ai trop parlé et puis j'aimerais surtout entendre Sophie et Hassan, donc la parole est...
For me, I just like to say a couple of things in English. Because there is a bill that can target anybody, Canadian or whoever. It's called Bill C-51.
That bill was created and was voted through with the Liberals. The Liberals promised to do changes. And any Canadian can be arrested, detained, without charge under Bill C-51. And don't get fooled. They don't issue security certificate now. They arrest you under another item of the immigration law, and it's kept secret. Prisons are filled with immigrants and people that are called threat to national security that don't have anyone to support them or help them because their cases are not as public as ours, unfortunately. And it's, I don't want to say it's time. It's been 15, 20 years since it's been time. Don't wait for your brother or your uncle or your friend to get arrested before to do something. Please. It's happened before and it will continue to happen. And I've been saying this same crap for 15 years. 15 years I've been saying it, and this guy's been saying it longer than I have. So what should we be doing now? You speak up. Write to your MP, write to the government. Tell them you're against deporting people to torture. Tell them you're against security certificates and any type of secret trials in this country. Give money to pay your legal defense. I have postcards. Don't leave here without signing a postcard and a petition, which I will send for you, by the way. I will do the work. Speak up. Speak to your community. Have a film event and invite us to speak. That's how the message goes around. And like I said, sometimes we spoke to crowds in the church basement of 10 people, but those 10 people went out and spoke to 10 other people, and that's how we made a difference. And we made a difference because we didn't go to Supreme Court once. We went to Supreme Court 3 times, Adil twice, and us. Again, we weren't as fortunate, but every single time we filled the entire Supreme Court rooms. Every room in the building was full, including the hallway, including the section between the toilets. Mayor Arar came to our last Supreme Court challenge, and it was so full, he sat where the bathroom was. That's how full it was. Because it's such an important issue. And now it's called Bill C-51, and it's called Other Section of the Immigration Act.
Yeah.
That was Medi Cayenne Club with O Canada. And before that, you heard excerpts from speeches from Adil Sherkawi and Sophie Herkat, who spoke at an event at McGill this past spring about the Canadian Security Certificate regime, which was upheld under an amended regime after the Sherkawi decision struck down. Okay, sorry. I'm reading this for the first time, the thing that I quickly wrote this morning. So basically what happened was Adil Sherkawi challenged the Security Certificate regime twice, along with Mohammed Harkat and I think one or two others who had security certificates issued against them. And following the second decision, the regime was struck down as unconstitutional on the grounds that it violated a person's right to a fair hearing under Section 7 of the Canadian Charter. After that decision, the Canadian government introduced a new amended security certificate regime whereby a person named on a certificate would be entitled to a special advocate, which is basically a third-party lawyer with a high level of security clearance who is privy to the evidence presented to the judge and can be there. It's still a secret trial, but the advocate is there on behalf of the named person. They have very limited powers to challenge the evidence, and they still basically cannot disclose any of it to the person who's named under the certificate. That is, as far as I understand, the only thing that has changed about the regime. So secret trials are still continue to be called constitutional, according to the court. The person named on the security certificate are still not entitled to know the case against them, which actually means that the special advocate's role is even more limited, because without being able to discuss the evidence with a named person, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to properly challenge the certificate.
And Sherkawi spoke about this when he was speaking at McGill, of just how the government was given a year to make the changes and they could do whatever they wanted to. And they basically just added one additional person who doesn't actually give any information, but it was enough to then uphold it as constitutional under Harkat, which...
It's hard to see how that isn't just window dressing, because it's just if the person that's named under the security certificate isn't allowed to hear any of the evidence or present their case, it's like...
I think it is window dressing. The same thing.
Sure.
And it's an interesting, like Sophie making the connection with Bill C-51 as well, and just kind of how so-called anti-terrorist legislation is kind of experimented, or just like we start with security certificates and then it gets wider, and these are the different ways that we can kind of amend something to make it look acceptable. Okay, well, now we're going to talk about a different side of Islamophobia. So this brings us to a presentation by Syed Hassan, who spoke on a panel held also at McGill this March that broadly addressed Islamophobia. So Hassan is a co-organizer of the Remember January 29th campaign, a movement that seeks to memorialize last year's Quebec mosque shooting. He's been on the show. We've played stuff on that he has said on the show before. And in this segment, you'll hear Hassan tying this campaign into a broader political framework of Islamophobia, but specifically Canadian militarism in the Middle East. So here it is.
My name is Hassan. I'm based in Toronto, as I said earlier. The territories that are taken care of by the Mississaugas, the Wendat people, and the Haudenosaunee. Our work in migrant justice, our work for a total transformation of our society is not possible, could not be possible, with us walking on a path that has been carved ahead of us by five series of struggle and defense by Indigenous warriors, by Indigenous women, by Indigenous nations. So the work that we're doing today, the conversations we need to have, are settled and unsettled by this overwhelming reality that we're in, that we live in a settler colony. On January 29, 2017, a young white man walked into a Quebec City mosque. He murdered six men: Abdul Karim Hassani, Abubakar Tabti, Ibrahim Abari, Azidine Sofian, Khalid Bilqasimi, and Mamadou Tarubari. I say their names to bring them into this room and with us. And I want to ask is, why did he shoot them? Why was he in the mosque? Why were those six Muslim men in that mosque? It is not a given that in occupied indigenous territories, these men, six men from North Africa, this French European settler descended, just emerged in front of each other. They did not appear out of history and out of context, right? Every step that was taken until that moment that brought them there weighs heavily on that moment. And if you're going to, in any way, be able to understand and to make sense of this massacre, we have to look at every step. We can't just begin with his upbringing. We can't just say, oh, they were here because they wanted to live a better life. All of the things must be questioned. Now, we have to understand here the plunder of the African continent. We have to talk about the transatlantic slave trade. We have to talk about colonialism. We have to talk about the fact that this young man was trained to shoot guns in the cadets. That he went to a gun range where he practiced shooting, and that gun range exists. Okay? That he had dinner with his family and had wine with them, kissed them goodbye, and then drove to a mosque and shot people. Okay? All of these are part of our conversation. Now, we've heard a lot today already about the representation of Muslims in the media. Thank you for that. As well as the broader context. So I want to add one other piece to this conversation. 2 million Muslims were killed between 2000 and 2013 in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq only. Approximately 487 people every day for 11 years. 487. Here I'm not even talking about Somalia and Yemen and Syria. What is important is that this did not happen somewhere in the distant past, but that there are bombs dropping on Afrin right now. There are drones active in Pakistan right now. There was a family that was murdered yesterday by American drones. So we live in a society where Muslims are killable, and it's not news. Again, 487 people every day for 11 years. The 15th anniversary of the Iraq War, does anyone know when it was? Last week. Same time as we, you know, hundreds of thousands of Americans walk against gun violence in their country, they did not, none of them speak about the gun violence that is being carried on by that country in our communities and our homes. And it's the same here. It wasn't spoken about in the Canadian press at all. So the normalization of death has to be really understood. And that it is about the normalization of death over there. So as liberals, progressives, and radicals, we may join forces and say, we oppose this mass shooting in Quebec City in a mosque. There can be hundreds of mosques of Muslims around the world where we will be murdered, and no one, even the most radicals of people here, will raise bat an eyelid. So we can say, okay, a young man walking into a mosque is a travesty, it's an exception, it's not allowed, but the fact that this university profits from the deaths of Muslims through its investment in war and militarism is unquestioned. We can oppose the gathering of right-wing fascists, we can all say Lamont is bad, but we will not take a stand against Trudeau selling weapons to Saudi Arabia to murder people in Yemen. We can agree, for example, that's happened in Ontario, in Toronto recently, when an 11-year-old girl said that her hijab had been pulled off, and Trudeau and Tory and all of the major leaders in the country can tweet about it, speak about it. That we are okay with. That is the level of hatred that we can join forces on. But the mass murder that has been taking place for decades and decades is allowed. We have to understand what kind of erasure is happening and how that mass murder allows and creates the conditions for the shooting in the mosque, for these hate crimes that are taking place. Okay. So that's kind of something I want us to talk about. How are those two interrelated? And part of this forgetting, I mean, we heard a lot about mainstream media representation of Muslims. I'm just going to give you one little factoid. The Quebec mosque shooting appeared in the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, and the CBC. In total, there were 194 articles written about it. 194. Okay. there were 768 written about the Boston Marathon bombing, which had fewer people who were killed and was in another country. So this structural erasure and forgetting is not just happening about people over there, but it is even happening about this thing that we may otherwise, the most truly that we might otherwise think is actually something we can, we're all united in our opposition to. Okay. So we have to frame this within a much, much longer history. We have to remember that when George W. Bush Jr. went to war in Iraq, he called it a great crusade. And the Crusades are a multi-century struggle by the West, by the Occident, I'm sorry, by the West against Muslims. And that this struggle of Crusades is actually an ongoing project. And it's one that liberals, progressives, or radicals, or conservatives are all stitched into in some way. And that's something that we really need to ask about. So, Dolores was talking about how so much of this conversation, you know, a lot of these wars are justified around the question of defending, you know, brown women from brown men. Right? We understand that. That this is the justification of war. And both Dolores and Safa talked about how at the same time, the vast majority of Islamophobic attacks in the West are actually directed against women. Right? So simultaneously, as in one hand, the state and the dominant paradigm kills Muslims for to protect Muslim women. On the other hand, here Muslim women are being targeted and attacked. And so this is the interrelation of that layer. That it isn't a rational system. It isn't a system that can actually be questioned on its own terms. We can't just understand Islamophobia as simply a singular form of hatred. It morphs itself. It recreates and reconstitutes itself. And primarily it functions through invisibilization and erasure, right? Which is why it is really important for us to talk about how January 29th has been systematically forgotten in this country. Systematic, right? There are no books, no one's writing poems, there are no art shows. It is as if we can reconcile ourselves with that moment simply now through a trial. The trial which started yesterday, right? So the trial for this murder started yesterday. And what we're faced with is this notion that either he gets convicted and you'll be like, justice has happened, or he won't, in which case we'll say, okay, the system isn't broken, it is built this way, which is what we saw with Colton Boochie and Tina Fontaine. But in either of those cases, the ongoing systematic mass murder of Muslims that has been taking place for decades and centuries will continue. Unless we as a society can ask ourselves, what is our collective complicity? What are the ways in which we work in the places with a lot, like, how does our tax dollars work in it? How do we make the electricity that builds those bombs? How do we work in the banks that invest and profit from them? How do we sit in this university that's existence is predicated on war and militarism that is primarily about Muslim death? Every aspect of our lives is integrated into this process. So when we are told to talk about Islamophobia simply as hate crimes against Muslims in North America, it is a sleight of hand. It is asking us to look away into a liberal project that everybody can agree on, while that much, much broader context is erased. So our work is to be able to do both. Of course, we don't want Muslims to be attacked here, or deported, or locked up in prison, or being denied jobs, or being kicked out of housing, or being misrepresented in the media. All of that is happening. But we have to do it without losing sight of this grand project that has been going on essentially since the Crusades. Bush was right. This is one project, so what are we going to do about it? Thank you.
Was an ordinary mother in 1932. My husband out of work, and more worries here than food. I was weary with asking the man for relief, feeling like a beggar, being treated like a thief. So when word of a protest started going round, Well, the air was almost festive with Christmas trees in view. But as we turned to leave the square and march the avenue, a sound I'd never heard before turned my heart to lead. The sound of a billy club cracking open heads. And I'd always taught my sons we were safe around police. But when they charged on horses, well, I dragged us off the streets. It made me so angry. They'd endanger children too. In silencing the voices of 1932, we were good people gathered in the square. It wasn't ease and comfort had driven us there, but they treated us like criminals for showing our despair. Oh, I remember well this bloody Tuesday.
Was We Were Good People by Edmonton-based folk musician Maria Dunn. And before that, you heard from Syed Hassan, co-founder of the Remember Jan 29 campaign, who spoke at a panel on Islamophobia here at McGill at the end of March. So that kind of brings us to the end of our show. I guess we just wanted to just comment quickly on why we decided to bring these two pieces together for the show today, specifically the security certificate regime and the Canadian militarism in the Middle East. We basically thought both of them were good examples of how rampant Islamophobia is in Canadian domestic and foreign policy. And as Hassan was saying, because of the lack of coverage, often these issues and aren't really spoken about, and that leads to kind of an invisibilization and kind of a corresponding normalization of some pretty disturbing things that are happening. So we just wanted to highlight them on the show today.
After Hassan's talk, there was a discussion at that panel, and something that people brought up was really how how threats are very much socially constructed. But in this context, in Quebec, according to Safa Shebi, 1.6% of the population is Muslim in Quebec. So it's a very, very like small population. And then if you look at media coverage, the media coverage that does happen is often very racist and scapegoating. Mm. But then looking at something like the security certificate regime, I mean, law is supposed to be some kind of normative framework or oppressive framework, however you want to see it. But the fact that this exists and is not talked about and is basically a tool that's just used against Muslim men, in a sense, also very much supports foreign policy.
It kind of justifies justifies Canadian militarism in the Middle East by creating this picture of like, oh my gosh, terrorism is the ultimate threat. And that's like, you know, that is like the basis of the security state and justifies all of these practices in the security certificate regime that basically allow for people to be detained without charges, without having any evidence disclosed against them. Yeah. And so these things are very much connected. And so that's why we wanted to kind of bring them together on the show. So thank you. I guess we'll wrap up there.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. Thanks to everyone who contributed this month. You've been listening to Legalese on CKUT 90.3 FM. You can listen to our show every second Friday of the month from 11 a.m. to noon on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal or online from wherever you are at www.ckut.ca. We will have an outro song by Neysetu, and up next we'll have Butcher T's Noontime Cuts. Thanks for listening.
إلى أن نرى الفكر الذي يضع عرقا كأعلى وآخر كأقل شأنا أخيرا ينبث وأبدا يحشر أخيرا ينبث وأبدا يحشر في كل مكان حر كل الحر وإلى أن لا نرى مواطنا أول وآخر ثاني في أي أمة وإلى أن يصبح لون أي كان لا يزيد أهمية عن لون العيون.
Laurie a hâte de célébrer son anniversaire au resto. Elle y a pensé toute la semaine. Elle a invité ses amis. Elle a acheté une nouvelle robe. Elle s'est rendue au resto. Elle n'a pas pu rentrer dans le resto. Elle a dû ranger sa nouvelle robe. Elle n'a pas pu voir ses amis. Et elle y a pensé toute la semaine.
N'attendez pas de frapper un mur. Faites-vous vacciner. Le passeport vaccinal est maintenant exigé pour fréquenter certains lieux publics. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
By stats, prison is a gold mine camp with no buybacks. Nigga, it's a wizard in the system holding all my blacks. It started in 1640, shackles around my ankles. Melanin meant that I can't go to schools or read, cause who's gonna serve my master? Also, the pastor described all my people as the sheep who exist to keep the land. We feed the economy, creep all the crops, but then feed on it modestly, consciously knowing you're lesser than. And lighter skin means that you're better now. So you in the house taking whips and probably dick, cause well, you a fetish now. Meanwhile, I'm grateful for all that I'm given. I'm picking this cotton in rhythm. I pray for a lot of the living. Escaping is probably a sin, and if God ever finds out that I want my freedom, well damn, then God's gonna call in the rap. Two horses with opposite maps. Those nooses, they up in the trees and I'm hanging, but I'll never fall like my pants. Then came the 13th Amendment, written in 1865. It says slavery is over. Except it's pay for doing crime. And then the things that they made illegal are things you associate with people who now education isn't equal. And they ain't getting paid enough to eat, so we still in and jugging this shit. We need to be fully equipped. The system the new slave master brought in to stop us and bullying shit. Cause before we were stealing and jugging, the laws we was breaking was loitering. We go to the bin, then we can't pay to find out the jail is who your employer is. This voyage is super intentional. You used to be students in medical. The Moors and indigenous blacks were the smartest and honestly truest professionals, literally teaching you about chemicals. My history isn't viewed on a pedestal. Try to tell me only few of my ancestors had anything to offer. If we wasn't strong, you would never bother. If we wasn't awesome, you never put all of your resources in just to get to conquer. If we ain't a problem, then why would you want all the youngins who black not to have a father? Cause slavery showed black youth for mad years that whiteness is right. Your ma getting fucked, your dad getting whipped,
but white is the light. And sometimes master blesses you for being a good slave and kills you off if you a bad one. So black mothers tell their daughters fuck the master, and they tell their sons they can't run. Mama raised the girls independent, and she raised the boys out of fear. These days black women representing the struggle that these black boys trying to clear. Man, we have so much work to do.
Afternoon, you're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked to CKT 90.3 FM.